The Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Adrian, please call the roll.
Chair Plasencia.
Here.
Vice Chair Morano. Representative Greco. Hawkins.
Here.
Josephs. Manning.
Here.
McCurdy.
Here.
Nixon.
Here.
Rizzo.
Here.
Rodriguez. Rommel.
Here.
Schoaf.
Here.
Ranking Member Thompson.
Here.
Representative Tuck.
Here.
Zika.
Here.
We have a quorum, sir.
A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee. Please make sure that cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent. Members, today we will hear three presentations, one from the Governor's Office on his budget recommendations for fiscal year 2021-22, one from the Department of Education on the Access to Better Learning and Education Tuition Assistance Program, also known as ABLE, and finally, we'll hear a presentation by Independent Colleges and Universities of Florida on the Effective Access to Student Education Tuition Assistance Program, also known as EASE. At this time, Teresa Klabaha, also known as TK, the Policy Coordinator of the Governor's Office of Policy and Budget Education, present the Governor's recommended budget. TK, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members. Again, my name is Teresa Klabaha. May I take this off? Thank you. Again, my name is Teresa Klabaha, TK, because it's Teresa Klabaha, and I am, as of 2 weeks ago, the Education Policy Coordinator with the Governor's Office in the Office of Policy and Budget of the Executive Office of the Governor. Joining me today, I have with me my policy chief, my budget chief, Shelby, and also Alex Kelly, the Chief of Staff of the Department of Education. And join us in the audience as well is Marshall Kreiser, the Chancellor of the State University System, should we have some specific questions about any of those particular issues. I want to thank my team here for helping to pull this budget together. It's extraordinary, and I really do want to appreciate them publicly for the work that they've done. Again, thank you for inviting us to present to you Governor DeSantis's Florida Leads Higher Education Budget Recommendations for the 21-22 fiscal year. I want to start first by highlighting that the Governor's Education Unit oversees three particular entities within the Department of Education, and it's represented in the budget, as you see here. The Department of Education supports the State Board of Education and houses several policy, administrative, and support functions that deal with pre-K all the way through post-secondary education. The Office of Early Learning is another entity which is administratively coordinated through the department. And finally, the Board of Governors is an entity that is representing the state university system. For today's presentation, I'm just going to do a brief overview and highlight how education budget fits within the total budget, and then I'll turn the mic over to my colleague here, Alex, to go through the specifics of the details there and talk with you about particular items. So to begin, I want to start with just kind of like, where does education fit in the broad picture of things? So on the left-hand side, you'll see of the total budget in a state of $96.6 billion total budget, you'll see in the orange slice there, that's education. Education basically is the second largest budget area of total funds behind human services, with $27.1 billion, which is about 28% of the total budget. If you look to the right side, you'll see there on general revenue, education is the biggest component there. That's the orange slice there, makes up about half, which is 49.7% of the total budget general revenue. So of the $35.8 billion in general revenue, the education budget basically is the biggest chunk of that at 17.8. Diving down a little bit deeper, out of the total budget for education, we broke it out here into sectors. So you could see of the sectors of education, which components take the most. As you see there, the orange is the public school component of total budget. And that basically is 57.4% of the total education budget. Today, we are here to talk with you about some of the other aspects of that budget. We'll be presenting in Representative Fine's committee on the other components. So funding for our state universities, you see there, of the total budget is about 19.1% of the entire education budget, followed by the colleges at 4.6, workforce education at 1.9, and student financial aid is rolled up into that other education component. Those are the elements that we will be talking with you today about. So the Florida Leads education budget overall reinforces Governor DeSantis' commitment to the pre-K-20 system and the work they do to support Florida's families and students. And specifically in this budget presentation, we will talk about the key investments across the sectors that try to move in that further in that direction. And for that, I'd like to invite Alex to come up and kind of go through the details on that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, and again, good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I appreciate, again, this opportunity to present Governor DeSantis' Florida Leads budget. And again, of course, when we're done, answer any questions that you may have. So first, we're just going to start with some highlights overall. And as you'll see on the slide here, the Florida Leads budget continues targeted incentives and performance funding aligned to our students' career goals in post-secondary. The budget maintains the $30 million investment that this legislature has made in workforce and 2+2 performance funding for our 28 state colleges. The budget also maintains incentive and performance funding for industry certification programs that our state's technical colleges and state colleges support. And the budget also maintains performance funding for our state university system, all incredibly successful initiatives. The governor's proposed budget also, for a third year, maintains the apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship program, the Pathways to Career Opportunities Grant program, $10 million program. And finally, the budget provides nearly $21 million split between the Florida colleges and Florida State Universities for the Florida Post-Secondary Academic Library Network, essentially a e-library of resources, of millions of resources that serve well over 1 million annually combined Florida college and Florida State University system students and the faculty and any researchers at those universities. An incredible investment for, incredible return on investment. Taking a look at some of our student financial aid programs, and overall, the Florida Governor's Florida Leads budget maintains the commitment to keeping post-secondary education affordable in Florida. The budget overall maintains no tuition increases, and the budget overall maintain support for all of these critical programs, five of which are highlighted here, that help our students have an affordable post-secondary education. And that the goals of this budget are really to maintain Florida's standing, as currently we have the nation's number one ranked post-secondary system between our state colleges and our state universities, and affordability is a key factor in that. The slide again highlights some of the larger state scholarship programs. And in all cases, all of these financial aid programs have all been adjusted to the most recent enrollment conference calculations to reflect what the believed enrollment will be for next school year. And with that, happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Members, before I open it up to questions, I have a couple questions I want to ask, and then we'll open it up to the members. Mr. Kelly, on slide six, when talking about Bright Futures, in our last subcommittee meeting, we discussed the tremendous growth and the cost of this program of more than $450 million, which is an increase of 200% over the last 4 years. What is the governor recommending to control the growth in this program and to make it more sustainable?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's nothing in this budget that pertains to any sort of limits on the growth of the program. Certainly that's something that we can work with you on. To your point, the growth in the program is, of course, a tremendous reflection on our students. It's grown because our students have excelled, and that's something we can all be proud of. It's sort of the challenge you're glad you have in some ways. That said, of course, in terms of the growth of the program, we'd be happy to work with you on that, and I look forward to that.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. And staying on Bright Futures, the most recent estimating conference adopted in our last subcommittee, and in our last subcommittee, we discussed a current year deficit of $14.2 million for the Bright Futures program. Do these recommendations address that current deficit in Bright Futures?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, these recommendations in the governor's budget don't address that point. We'd like to get a look at the next estimating conference just to see if that $14 million holds. And of course, we would work with you on that challenge if in fact that holds.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. I have another question. So there's been a lot of conversation in the past few years about the large sums of money that are carried forward by each year by colleges and universities. In light of their fund balances, how much of the 6% holdback does the governor recommend reducing from colleges and university in the current year? And just a little more clarity, by mean reducing of the 6% holdback, how much are you recommending that we return back to the state colleges, to the universities, and how much should we not?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this time, no final decision, no final recommendation has been made. The thinking is to get into the fourth quarter of the year and assess that, and then determine during the fourth quarter what a recommendation might be.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly, and thank you for your patience. I have one more question. Last year, there was a shift from the traditional funding model for the Florida college system to a tier-based model. I understand you all made an across-the-board reduction to colleges in your budget by 3%. The question is the governor no longer supportive of the tier-based model? That's the first question, because I don't see it in your bill. And the second, what was the rationale for an across-the-board reduction as opposed to a more targeted approach?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can't speak, and perhaps the staff from the Office of Policy and Budget can, to the first part of the question about the long-term support. What I can say is the approach overall was, in this proposed budget, to propose a 3% reduction, knowing that, as you pointed out, right now our state colleges and state universities are both functioning and functioning very well with a 6% holdback for the current year. So the thought was to half that for next year, believing that a 3% reduction for next year, a one-time non-recurring 3% reduction, could be managed. Also, in light of the fact that our colleges and universities have been the beneficiaries of direct receipt of funds from both the first and now second Stabilization Act.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Members, are there any questions? Representative Mariano, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on slide 5. You mentioned the Florida Postsecondary Academic Library Network. Could you go into a little more detail on that? Is that an existing program? And if not, what exactly does that look like for our students and our universities?
Sure. Thank you. Yes, that is an existing program. It was based out of the Complete Florida program. It was one piece of it, and from what we would say it's the most essential piece of it. The Complete Florida program was vetoed last year. The college system and university system collaborated thereafter to essentially develop a plan. Really, you're seeing the culmination of that plan to maintain those supports for our students. And really pull them out from the collective package they were previously included in. So it is currently in existence, and it's just pulling that, between our state colleges and our universities, we believe to be the most essential piece. We worked with the governor's office on this, and to really kind of paint that vision for the future for those services.
Thank you. Can you go into more detail about what exactly the program is and what purpose it serves? Is it available to all students? Does it have certain textbooks?
Yes, thank you. The program really is your textbooks, your curriculum, literally millions of e-resources that are available to any state college or state university student. So much of the curriculum at the post-secondary level has transitioned over years to the internet, including additional supplemental resources that many students leverage. Many students and teachers, many instructors leverage at the post-secondary level for assignments, for research tasks. And so that library has really grown into incredible research and incredible return on investment, because it literally is millions of volumes of text subscriptions that are really closing on probably 1.2 million post-secondary students use every year, plus any professor or visiting researcher at any university or college. So it's quite a utilized library of resources.
One follow-up.
You're recognized.
Thank you. As a student currently, are these academic journals or are these textbooks? Because I personally have never heard of this tool, so just wanted to see, are these tools that students are actually using in everyday coursework, or are these just extra supplemental tools for them to use upon their request?
Sure. Thank you. Yes, both. It's really all of the above. And of course, we'd be happy to, if you'd like, we're happy to follow up in much greater detail. It really is all of the above. It's all types of resources that are used, text, also, you know, like periodicals, other types of research resources, other types of supplemental resources that students are using. And we'd be happy if you'd like to get you much greater detail.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Kelly, will this also include the distance learning catalog?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you. Ranking Member Thompson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. Over the years, there's been concern about scholarships based exclusively on merit and having parents who are able to pay but don't pay. And of the financial aid programs that you highlighted, how many take into consideration need and how many are exclusively based on merit?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, there definitely are a few that are based on need. I don't have a total number, and I could get you an exact figure that are based on need. But for example, your Florida student assistance grants are based on need. Your Florida work experience program is based on need. So there are several need-based programs in there to complement those that are based on academic, and be happy to get you a complete built-out list with all of exactly all their purposes.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rizzo, before I recognize you, just I know everyone's probably noticed it, but you and I appreciate it, Mr. Kelly, but you don't have to go through the chair if you're going back and forth on questions and answers, as long as you're not speaking over each other. And Representative Rizzo, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kelly, for that presentation. This proposed budget, is this an increase, a decrease, as compared to last year's budget?
Thank you. Overall, it's pretty comparable to last year's budget. Off the top of my head, the vocational rehabilitation budget is a slight, like literally a couple $100,000 increase. The blind services budget is a slight decrease. You know, in terms of the overall colleges and universities budget, a slight decrease overall. But of course, preserving those critical programs that have provided great results. And then of course, the scholarship programs have all just been adjusted to enrollment. But overall, the net difference is a fraction of a percent.
Thank you. And also my final question, with respect to Bright Futures, what is the projected enrollment in this or participation next year? And also, what are the trends as you see for the next 2, 3, 4 years as far as participation in that program?
Thank you. Yes, the estimate for next year is 124,000 participating students. Overall, Bright Futures has continually trended upwards in terms of student participation, and we would expect that would probably continue.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Nixon, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Hi, thank you for your presentation. My question is centered around Bright Futures as well. As a Bright Futures former recipient over almost 20 years ago. Oh, wow, it really hit me today. But just based on the conversation that you, in your presentation, in regards to the deficit that Bright Futures is facing of the over $14 million, I'm really interested to know why what's the rationale behind the small change for funding in regards to the Bright Futures program as opposed to the huge jump and increase in the Benequisto scholarship program? So I'm really interested in figuring that out.
Sure. Yes, thank you. And by the way, I should clarify too earlier, I think I left out like a little piece of my prior answer. Bright Futures this year is a little bit of a decline. Overall, I'm speaking long term, we would expect the trend to pick back up, but this year is a little bit of a decline. Overall, for the Benequisto scholarship program, we've seen a significant popularity and enrollment in the program. So the projection is just purely based on the most recent data that we have and that growth in the program this year and the popularity. That program has done an excellent job at attracting national merit scholars to want to either stay or come to our universities and kind of attract that talent. And so it's just been a very popular program. And so the proposal here just reflects, based on the estimating conference, that likely continued increase. In terms of Bright Futures and the overall strategy, Of course, we have multiple estimating conferences during the year, and essentially these recommendations always just reflect that most recent data. And it's not uncommon that if the next estimating conference were to perhaps show a spike in enrollment or some other data point that suggested there's going to be an increase, EDR, House, Senate, Governor's Office, we the department would all work together to work on that recommendation and see if we needed to increase it.
Representative Hawkins, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going to ask kind of a freshman question, but when we're dealing with money, seeing how trends and things happen, and building on Representative Rizzo's question, would it be possible to get what last year's was and maybe some bullet points why those changes were made to some of these categories sent to us?
Sure, absolutely. And I think we could probably really give you a good detailed explanation of that, probably follow up after the meeting, if that's okay.
All right, thank you.
Okay. All right, well, thank you, Mr. Kelly. Thank you, Ms. TK. Next, we have Susan Pridgen, Deputy Commissioner of Finance and Operations at the Department of Education, who will present on the ABLE program. Ms. Pridgen, you are recognized.
Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to speak about the ABLE program. What is ABLE? ABLE is the acronym for Access to Better Learning and Education. This program is administered through the Florida Department of Education and the Office of Financial Student Financial Assistance. This program was created in 2004 to provide tuition assistance to Florida residents who are enrolled at independent for-profit institutions in pursuit of an undergraduate degree. Grants are made available to students meeting eligibility requirements, which are not related to the student's financial need or merit, or academic merit, excuse me. The maximum award for the 2021 academic year is established in the General Appropriations Act and is $2,841 and is expected to aid 1,620 students. In order for students to be eligible to receive an ABLE grant, they must meet several qualifications. Students must be a United States citizen or eligible non-citizen, be a Florida resident, not be in default on federal student loans, working towards their first baccalaureate degree, and enroll for at least 12 credit hours in a secular program. The 2020 GAA requires a report to be generated combining various metrics and relevant information about ABLE. Specifically, the report covers student eligibility requirements, a breakdown of various student financial aid sources, graduation rates, job placement rates, and total students and dollars disbursed. This report is generated in September for the prior year due to timing for when data becomes fully available from various reporting sources. Students receive financial aid from multiple sources. The data for this chart is provided by the Federal Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System, we call that IPEDS. This data encompasses both resident and non-resident students attending these institutions at any of the institution's state nationwide campuses. IPEDS doesn't report data by state or individual campuses. Graduation rate is also provided by IPEDS. This data represents the total reported graduation rates for campuses, both in Florida and out of Florida, for first-time, full-time students reaching graduation. That is, these are students from freshman year through their graduation year. This data isn't available for only Florida campuses. Job placement rates are provided by the Florida Education and Training Placement Information Program. It's called FETPIP. And we also, at the department, run these types of data. Due to changes in the maximum award amount, institutions are able to provide higher awards to students at the expense of fewer grants. Each institution, though, they determine the eligibility criteria. So each college or university private determines how they give those awards out. And because of this, the average award is sometimes lower than the max award because they give it to more students that are eligible. As mentioned before, ABLE grants are not based on need or merit. The data is collected by OSFA and represents the GPA of only ABLE grant recipients. And this data that you see here is only for Florida campuses. The list of institutions are the lists that are approved to receive ABLE funds for 2021 academic year. While these institutions may not be headquartered in Florida, they meet eligibility requirements for participation in state-funded programs by maintaining a campus in the state and serve eligible Florida students. Each institution received federal funds as part of two rounds of the federal stimulus packages. These amounts represent the total funding nationwide. We do not have the visibility yet to see the amount of funds sent just to Florida campuses. And that is the end of my presentation regarding ABLE.
Thank you, Ms. Pridgen. And members, like before, I have a couple questions before I open it up to more questions. Ms. Pridgen, on slide four, well, actually through most of the slides, but it's first highlighted in slide four, you went over all the different key metrics, for example, like graduation rate. Have you seen any collaborative efforts from the recipient institutions in trying to increase or improve on those performance measures?
Actually, is Mr. Mortham in attendance?
Yes, Mr. Mortham, I think Ms. Pridgen.
I would need to have him come elaborate on that a little bit.
Mr. Mortham, if you can introduce yourself, please.
Good morning, committee. My name is Alan Mortham, and I am the executive director of the Florida Association of Post-Secondary Schools and Colleges.
Yes, you may.
Okay. I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question?
Sure. So the slides we've seen have seen multiple metric measures on performance for the different recipients of the ABLE, the institutions that receive the ABLE grant. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, has there been any collaborative effort by the institutions in trying to increase these metrics? For example, you have, Herzing College has a 9% graduation rate. The job placement rate looks very good because it's 90%, but when you take into account that only 9% of the students are graduating, probably going to have a false positive on that 90% because there's so few of the students graduating. So when we take a look at the averages, for example, on graduation rates, the average for our state university system for graduation rate is 69%, and there's not a single ABLE institution, well, there's one, that's at higher than the average of our state university system. So we're trying to figure out if there's some collaborative effort by these institutions to increase their performance on these metric measures.
Sure. First of all, what I need to start off with is, some of these graduation rates, it depends on how they're compiled. Is this a four-year graduation rate? Is it a five-year graduation rate? Generally speaking, our schools are very comparable and in some instances actually higher than the state rate. When it comes to these specific schools that are utilizing ABLE, which is actually a very small percentage, unfortunately, in this case, it is lower. I couldn't tell you about the school that's at 9%. Unfortunately, they're not one of our member schools, so I don't have that information readily available, and I apologize for that.
I have a couple more questions.
Sure.
Would it be possible to provide a breakdown of tuition and fees by institution? Because we haven't been able to get that.
Okay, I will put that on my list and get that to the committee, absolutely.
All right, members, are there any questions? Representative Nixon, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Also, thanks for answering some questions. Could you also provide us, I know you may not have it right now, just the demographics of the students that are enrolled in the program as well, that are recipients of this grant?
Absolutely.
Okay, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Representative Joseph, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. Just trying to make sure, so Pell Grants, do those factor into these programs?
Yes, most of these students are eligible for Pell Grants.
Okay, so most as in like what percentage?
I believe there was a slide. I'm sorry. And if you look at it, it was probably quickly on average well over 75%, I'm going to say.
Okay, so that's what I suspected. And through you, Mr. Chair, one or two more? Okay, thank you. So my, I guess, follow-up question would be, what has been the projected change or requested change to those particularly Pell Grant eligible students and or programs?
I don't think there would be any change as far as the projected. I think it's fairly level funded to this point, but that would be in the LBR of the department.
Okay, thank you.
Members, any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Morton. Thank you, Ms. Pridgen. Next, we have Bob Boyd, President and CEO of Independent Colleges and Universities of Florida, and he will present on the EASE program. Mr. Boyd, you are recognized.
There you go. Good morning, Mr. Chair, Chair Plasencia, Vice Chair Mariano, members of the committee. Thank you for having me today. My name is Bob Boyd. I'm the president and CEO of ICUF, which is the Independent Colleges and Universities of Florida. what I want to do very quickly, I want to talk about who ICUF is, who we serve, and then I want to talk about the EASE grant, which, by the way, was created in 1979, and ABLE was based on EASE 25 years later. So EASE started as the Florida Tuition Voucher and then became FRAG, you may have heard that, and then became the EASE, started in 79. And then I want to talk about EASE accountability real briefly, and then the CARES Act funding that went to our institutions. So again, ICUF is the 30 more traditional nonprofit SACS-accredited institutions in Florida, and SACS is important because the public state universities and the state colleges are also SACS accredited. So we're the nonprofit equivalent of your public institutions in Florida. We were founded in 1965, our association, and a lot of our schools like Rollins and Stetson, we are the oldest higher ed institutions in Florida. So a lot of our institutions were around long before the publics were here in Florida. I went to Rollins College. I'm an ICUF grad in beautiful Winter Park. And also, on this committee, I think Representative Zika went to St. Leo. Representative Tuck went to Stetson College of Law. Representative Thompson went to University of Miami. Representative Rizzo went to UM and Nova Southeastern, which is an ICUF school. Representative Greco went to UM College of Law. And I believe Representative Mariano's sister is at St. Leo, although she may have graduated. So there are some ties to ICUF on the committee. One thing I just want to say, we keep hearing about our public university sector being the best in the country, and I agree 100%. We've got a fantastic public university sector, but you never hear about the privates, the nonprofit privates in Florida. Just to give you two quick examples, Embry-Riddle by U.S. News and World Report, just January 26, was named the best undergraduate online baccalaureate degree program in the U.S. So the best online program in the United States, actually for four of the last 6 years, they were named the best online degree program in the U.S. And then just another example, and there's many, Florida Southern, their business school, which is the Barnett School of Business, Their faculty was ranked number one in a national publication on business schools in the U.S. So they beat out Bucknell, UVA, Wake, University of Pennsylvania, Texas. So according to this publication, they've got the best business faculty in America, which, and those are just two examples. There's many, many more. If you could go to the first slide there. So who is ICUF? Just very briefly, again, we have 158,000 students in our sector. We have 30 schools. We have 30 main campuses, but we have 190 sites around Florida. So we cover Florida. We have 40,000 employees in Florida. So when you talk about economic development and our impact, a lot of our schools are in very rural counties, and we're the economic anchor in those counties. And then the other thing that's interesting in the slide on the bottom left, 40% of all master's degrees and PhDs are awarded by ICUF. 45% of all professional degrees in Florida are awarded by ICUF. And then we produce 20% of all the baccalaureate degrees in Florida. So we're a big key component of higher education in Florida, maybe more than you realize. And then the other thing I wanted to point out, 50% of our students are minorities. 50% have income under $60,000, their family income. 80% receive aid from our institutions, and 40% are Pell recipients. So I'm going to talk about that a little more, but that's who we are. On the next slide, and I like to use this slide. So EASE, again, was created in 1979. This is higher ed choice. This is Florida's higher ed choice, where the money follows the student. The student gets the award of $2,841 a student and can decide which institution to go. So we like to call it higher ed choice that was created by a bipartisan legislature back in 1979. If you look at this slide, for every $1 million that the taxpayers invest in higher ed, we produce 314 degrees to the publics and they produce 45 degrees. This is a great return on investment. It's a good bang for the buck for the taxpayers. This is not to criticize the state universities in any way. Again, I think we have one of the best state university systems in America. This just shows you how subsidized the public sector is when you talk about return on investment. We have a tremendous return on investment given the amount of money that we get. And we do this all, and I think it was on your slide from your last committee meeting, ICUF receives less than 1.8% of the higher ed budget. So our return on investment is high, given the investment by the state. And by the way, we're updating this chart. We were waiting on the iPads, which is data on our students, and I will get you a new return on investment chart by the start of the session. The next slide gets back to what I was talking about, of who ICUF and EASE serve. In the last 20 years, probably because of Bright Futures, and it's counterintuitive to a lot of legislators, the demographics have shifted in the state universities and in ICUF. And if you look at this chart, our sector serves a higher percentage of these students than the public sector. You wouldn't think that, but look at this chart. So percentage of minorities, we have 8 out of the 10 highest percentage of minorities in our institutions in Florida. We have 8 out of 10 of the highest percentage of older students in Florida, 25 and older. And that's on the top right. The same is true, 8 out of 10 with the lowest median undergraduate family income. And then you will see our Pell percentages. 9 out of 10 of the top Pell eligible students in Florida are at ICUF schools. So remember, so ICUF has 3 of the 4 HBCUs in Florida. FAMU is the one public. We have 5 Hispanic serving institutions, which are majority Hispanic. And then we have 4 majority-minority institutions. So we have 12 institutions that serve this demographic. And you may not have thought that until you saw this chart, but the demographic of who we serve is not necessarily the traditional first-time-in-college 18-year-old that's in the public sector. Now, what do you get for that return on investment on the next slide? This is just one example. For less than that 1.8% of the budget, 6 of the top 7 starting salaries, according to this publication, come from graduates of our institutions, and you'll see those there. So you're getting, a great return on investment, and you're getting good workforce, talented workforce and educated workforce coming from our sector. Now, let me talk about EASE accountability. So every year, ICUF, by I think the date is September 1st, we have to file an accountability report with the Speaker, the Senate President, the Commissioner, the House and Senate Appropriations staff, and it's in the budget every year, the metrics that we have to report on, and then it's also in the statute. So what ICUF does is they combine it into one report. We just finished our 2020 report. And the data, and I think Abel went through this as well, is we've got to give test scores and GPA and entrance requirements, the percentage of Pell Grants, Bright Futures, and other state assistance, total federal loan amounts, retention rates, transfer rates, completion graduation rates, and graduate employment rates and earnings. So just to pull out a very few amount of those metrics, if you look at the first slide here, this is Pell, Bright Futures, and other state aid. And just to give you the aggregates, 40% of our students get Pell, which was in the earlier chart. 19% get Bright Futures. So it's only 19% of our students get Bright Futures, and that's EASE students. 35% get FSAG, and that's Florida's need-based grant. Under the FSAG, by the way, which is the Florida Student Assistance Grant, you have an award that goes to the publics, the state colleges, ICUF schools, and then the proprietary schools. So that's the metrics of ICUF schools with regard to state aid. And by the way, I do want to add that ICUF colleges, the members of our association, we provide an average of $15,300 per student in institutional aid. So if the tuition at Florida Southern was $40,000, the student that's going to Florida Southern gets a package. They would get EASE, they would get FSAG, perhaps they would get Pell, and they would get institutional discounts on that tuition. The next slide is federal loans. And I will say to you on this is not just EASE students. This is all undergraduate students. And you can see the amount there, and I can answer any questions on that. the next slide is retention rates. Now, retention rates is the percentage of students that come back year to year, not the graduation rate, which is who graduates. And, you know, a lot of students have reasons for not returning. They may have family, health, or economic reasons. I think that's going to increase under COVID. But our retention rate, our total retention rate is 76%, which is pretty good. It compares favorably with the publics. It's not as high, but it compares favorably. Even though you got to remember, go back to that gold chart of who we serve, the top 10 chart, the public institutions probably on average serve a more traditional affluent student body and with higher Bright Futures recipients. So to compare favorably to the publics on retention rates is a good thing. Let me go to graduation rates, the next slide. These are six-year graduation rates. Our overall graduation rate is 57%. I will say that the last 3 years it was 53%, and then last year it was 54%, so it is increasing. We have initiatives at every one of our schools to increase graduation rates. You can see there we have a bunch of diverse institutions, as you can see in ICUF, but you can see on this chart, you know, there's some schools where it's low, and some where it exceeds the average. I think I just heard the average at the state universities is 69%. But remember who we serve. Again, we have three of the four HBCUs, we have minority institutions, we have a higher percentage of Pell eligible, we have a higher percentage of students with family income below 60,000. So I think I would argue that we compare favorably when you look at the demographic of who we serve. The next chart is graduate employment rates and earnings. And I will tell you that our average is 46,000. So a recent graduate from ICUF will make approximately on average 46,000. That also compares favorably to the publics, the state colleges, and the state universities, which, you know, makes EASE's return on the investment, the amount of money you put in, that much more compelling. The next slide is our workforce production. So you'll see that we produce a lot of STEM graduates, we produce a lot of healthcare professionals, Education, by the way, is only undergrad. That doesn't include masters and beyond, so that piece of that pie would get bigger. But for example, if you add STEM and health professionals, that's 34% of our graduates. So I think that's a good chart to show you what we're doing in Florida for workforce. The next thing I want to talk about very briefly is the CARES Act. And I've got, we passed the CARES Act 1, and the money in CARES Act 1 is out and it's spent, so we have actual allocations on the next slide. The money in the next, I call it CARES Act 2, but I know it's the Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act. But that money is just now being allocated. So my chart is estimates, and that's as of January 13th, because I don't think our institutions have all received the money yet. So just to know, that second column are estimates. But what I wanted to say is, so let's talk about the spring and the summer 20 term. So coronavirus hit, and I think on March 13th, a lot of the country was shut down because of COVID. So on April 15th, 2020, ICUF did a survey. The survey showed that we lost 60, this is just ICUF institutions, we lost $60 million in lost revenue due to refunds for room and board, and $90 million in lost earnings for refunds due to summer program cancellations and summer courses canceled. This was just March to April in the first month of the coronavirus. So that's $150 million in just the first month. We have not done another survey, but that was just for the spring and summer of 20. For the fall of 20 and 21, you know, we continue to have expenses that challenge us. We've got to pay for testing. In athletics, you got to test all athletes. C-19 contract tracing, PPEs, you know, plexiglass barriers, restructuring of classrooms, online learning, shifting into the online learning. So all ICUF schools have had to meet these expenses. And I just do want to let you know that every ICUF school, all 30 ICUF schools, they all are open and in person today. There's in-person instruction. Now, some have a hybrid model where the students can choose to go online or go in person, but I will tell you that every one of these schools is open as of today. So the last thing I want to talk about with regard to this CARES money is the parameters on how you can spend this money. So let's just talk about the CARES Act. So the CARES Act, 50% of this money had to go to emergency student aid. Just so I could read you this, emergency grants to students are intended to be cash rewards, not for the institution to cover tuition or other account balances. The institution has no oversight or control of how the student spends this money. This was the first tranche in CARES Act 1. 50% of this money had to go to students, but many institutions spent 100% of their money on students. So it's at least 50%. And so the students could spend this on rent, on laptops, on tires. I mean, it was all up to the student control, and that was the first tranche on the CARES Act. The second tranche, the rest of what's left, the institution could only spend it on pandemic-related expenses. So they could not spend it on lost revenue or earnings. It could not go to the school's general revenue fund. They had to spend it on things that I discussed, like the shift to online learning, PPEs, testing, contract tracing, et cetera. So there was very strict strings attached to the CARES Act 1 funding. This money, by the way, has all been spent. I think we have until March 13th to spend the money. But the money has all been spent, it did not begin to cover all the expenses of the institutions. Under CARES Act 2, the same provision applied in the second column. 50% of this money has to go to student aid, once again. So the institutions have to provide the same dollar amount for student aid. But the institutional allocation, they gave it a little bit more flexibility. They said you can use the funds to defray expenses, including lost revenue, reimbursement for expenses, technology, staff training, student support services, et cetera. So they opened up CARES Act 2, again, what I call it, that second tranche. But again, and I'd like to quote this statistic, What is left in CARES Act 2 totals just 1% of the total colleges and universities' coronavirus-related expenses nationwide. So, again, this doesn't begin to fill the hole for us, but, we welcome the help, and we continue to have these expenses going forward. Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions, but that's my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. And before I open it up to questions, I just have one question. Actually, two. Great presentation. It looks like a lot of your institutions are doing a great job. There are a couple who seem to be falling behind. I looked on the graduation rates. There's one at 13%. There's one at 17%. So I guess my question to you as well is, are there any concerted efforts in trying to work with those institutions that are far below your average to try to increase their the different performance measures that you have?
Yeah, and remember, we're private institutions, so when we talk about collaboration on tuition fees and graduation rights, there's antitrust issues. So there's not really institution-to-institution collaboration, but there's initiatives at every one of our schools to get that graduation rate up, especially the ones that have the low percentage. But again, you got to remember who they're serving, what the demographic is, how many Pell eligible, how many minority students, and what their income was coming into the school. But yes, there's initiatives at every school. The rate has gone up, like I said, 53 to 54 to 57 this year. ICUF has initiatives to work with each individual school. Any ideas that the legislature has, we'd be happy to listen to, but we continue to make that our top priority.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. And then my last question is, we're trying to get, again, understanding what your tuition and fees are by institution, and we're having a hard time getting that data. Is that something that you could, or possibly your institutions could provide?
We can provide that, absolutely. We can get that to you soon.
Thank you, Mr. Boyd. Members, are there any questions? Representative Mariano, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming today. I just have a question on the federal loan slide.
Yep.
Are those numbers annually, or are those what a student per average is looking at when they graduate?
It's for that academic year.
Okay.
So when they would graduate, yes.
Would we be able to get what the average student is coming out with in student debt at the end of their term?
We can try to provide that for you.
Okay.
Again, remember that ICUF is not a regulatory body, so we can't just say we need this data, but we usually get 100% participation in a survey, and that's how we would collect that. So I think we can collect that for you.
Thank you. And if you could also get that based on, because I see how many students are receiving federal loans.
Yep.
But how many students there are that are compared to those who are taking and who aren't taking loans. So how many students in general in the total population? Thank you.
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Representative Joseph, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So first of all, I wanted to thank you and your on behalf of the institutions for all of the work that you do in the community. It's a Herculean effort with a lot of the students, particularly in the communities that probably have some of the highest needs. So that's one. My question for you is, I was a little confused about your tranche one of the CARES Act funding that was that the students were allowed to spend on their own, and you gave a couple of examples of things that they were spending. Were there not any specific requirements that they had, like the institutions, for that funding? And if so, like how much was spent? I'm trying to understand that.
In the federal bill, and I'm going to read you the language, the institution has no oversight or control over how the student spends the money. In fact, the bill talked about the institutions may provide cash awards via check, electronic transfer, debit cards, payment apps, but only if such distributions remain unencumbered. They can use student accounts as a pass-through delivery, but not credit the account. So in other words, I think they wanted to put a wall between the institutions dictating how that money was spent or trying to control the money in any way or giving them credits. But emergency cash grants to the students for the shift to online, maybe they had to buy laptops, maybe they had to buy Wi-Fi, for the shift and the closure of the schools and the shift online. So there was a very bright line in the legislation.
Okay. What period of time are we talking?
That I think the money for CARES Act 1 has to be spent, and I may be wrong, but on March 13th, 2021, I think Marshall may know the answer to that, because 1 year is up, so they had to spend it within 1 year. But I can tell you that in all of our schools, that money is spent.
It's spent.
In CARES 1.
In CARES 1. So yes. That was authorized on what date?
I think it was passed around March 13th.
Okay.
2020.
Yes, sir.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Representative Schoaf, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In looking at the graduation employment rate and earning sheet, I noticed you've got one college that is just above 50% employment rate, and the earnings are right at $31,000 a year. I'm asking, do you find that those courses, the courses that that school is offering, are not preparing them for the workforce today, or are they not in touch with employers' needs? I'm just curious specifically why they have such a low employment rate.
That's a good question. I will point out that the data does not include students that leave the state, number one. So if they go outside of Florida or leave the state for employment elsewhere, they're not in this data. So that may hurt the data a little bit, or become self-employed. So if you become self-employed, you're not included in the data. And then, by the way, Beacon College, the reason that's not available is their cohort was only 10 students or less. So the data is not in there. But it's a good question. I can make that inquiry of that institution. I think that if we had the true data, those numbers would be higher. But I do think they're preparing those students. But as you know, certain professions have higher starting incomes. And I think we do, comparably, when you look at that other slide, we do a good job with starting salaries at on average at our institutions. But it's a good question, and I can explore it further.
Representative Rizzo, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have a couple of questions. Thank you very much for that presentation. So I noticed on your slide that you have approximately 46,000 as of 2 years ago student participation.
I can give you the exact number. It is 41,063 students receive E's, and that's from the latest Student Financial Aid Estimate Conference.
All right. Yeah, I saw 46 on that one slide that had, you know, a bunch of information on it.
And remember, those are estimates, so you're going to be getting an estimate in March for the budget for this year.
Now, this E's grant, it is first come, first served? Once the fund is gone, it's done?
It's the schools actually give the numbers of, you have to be a Florida resident, a full-time student, and the schools give the estimates to the DOE. And if there's too many students, the award is prorated in term two. So the budget gives the amount of 2841. By the way, it was 3,500 a few years ago. But if they if there's more students than the estimate, they will prorate in the second term. But that has not happened, to my knowledge, in the last 5 or 6 years. So that's how that worked. If there's less students, the award stays at 2841, and then you have a reserve amount of dollars coming back for the next budget year.
So there has been a bit of a surplus that just rolls over?
Well, remember, because you're going estimate to estimate. So right. Yes, there has been a surplus in the past. I don't think there will be a surplus this year from the numbers I've seen.
That participation rate, has that been trending upwards? Has that been trending downwards?
Just over the last 5 years, we have had consistent 1-5% growth every year. And every year, one of our budget challenges, even though it's a really small part of your budget, is we've got to come up with extra dollars to fund the growth to keep the student award where it is. This year, fortunately, unfortunately because of COVID, the growth rate has steadied off. I don't think that number 41063 is a decrease. I think it's just a reduction in the growth rate.
Okay.
And by the way, that your 46,000 number is a headcount, and this is an FTE number, the 41,063.
Okay. And is that that increase, is that due to an increase in the amount of schools, or is that within the current framework?
That's within the current framework. And remember, this is only for Florida residents. So with a good solid frag, where you want to create access to BA degrees for the state of Florida, our schools shift their in-state, out-of-state percentages as the frag goes up. So you will see, if I had a chart, you will see, I'm sorry, I keep using the frag, I've been doing this for so long, but as the ease goes up, the amount of students in the program go up. And that's what Florida wants to try to incentivize, which is create an affordable, good return on investment, access to a baccalaureate degree.
And I only have two more questions, Chair. Thank you for your indulgence. The award amount, is that the same regardless of tuition at, yes, at each university?
Yes. So that's a good question. Again, we have a very diverse group of institutions with diverse tuition. And the award amount is the award amount. And again, the students put it together with a pack. You know, they create a package, mm-hmm, of institutional aid, Pell, Bright Futures, to be able to afford it. And that's why it's so important. If the ease goes up $10, you may say, oh, that's only $10. But for a student putting together a package trying to afford a institution, it means a lot.
No, absolutely. And actually, I was a recipient of this award at University of Miami back in 1985, and it was about $800. But it helped.
I got it at Rollins in 1981, and it was $750, but it was called the Florida Tuition Voucher.
Tuition voucher, absolutely. Yep. And my final question, so is there a parameter on what this can be used for? So, for example, if the tuition has been met already and the grant has been awarded, is there something that it cannot be used for?
It cannot be used for anything other than tuition assistance. This is a tuition assistance grant. So, again, the money technically is the students, but it flows through the school, and it has to be used for tuition assistance. It cannot be used for any other purpose.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Tuck, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boyd, thank you for the presentation, first of all. So in my district, we have a state college that has partnerships with these ICUF institutes, and it's a great for our community, rural, and gives us more options. Do these numbers reflect those partnerships? And if not, is there a way to measure the success of that partnership?
We have partnerships all over the state. We call them 2+2 partnerships. For example, Flagler has a great education program at TCC, where they go the first 2 years at TCC and the third and fourth at Flagler. But which numbers? Are you talking about the ease numbers? If you're in a 2+2 program and you're a Florida resident, you would get the ease in the second part of that partnership.
Sure. So the partnership that I mean, so we have, and it may be different everywhere, but you can actually take, for example, Hodges University classes, mm-hmm, on the state college campus, mm-hmm, and it's great for our students. Do the graduation rates, job placement rates, and things of that nature reflect those partnerships in this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
And we love the 2+2 partnerships, by the way. We think that's a good cost-effective way to produce a baccalaureate degree where there's geographic issues with students. And Hodges is a good example.
Absolutely, yes, sir.
Any other questions, members? Thank you, Mr. Boyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for everyone who came here to present. Members, this concludes our committee agenda. There is no further business before the committee. Seeing none, Representative Schoaf moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.